Chapter 12. Thaddeus had been introduced to Marvis Michelman, Eileen's roomie at Bennington, to Justin and Eustace Loveland, her older sister and brother-in-law from Iowa City, to Eileen's mom and aunt, to Rex Howe, a dashing commercial pilot out of St. Louis, who, Thaddeus feared, probably already had something going with Eileen, to Father Emil Pritchard, the priest who would be conducting the midnight mass at Eileen's church, and many others, too many to remember all at once. The house was bright and noisy, and small children were scampering and retrieving presents from under the 7-foot tree and holding them up and shaking them and listening for clues. Two white English sheepdogs were on their way back and forth through the crowd, seeking handouts and begging when ignored. They were both plump and looked well-fed to Thaddeus, as did most of the guests. At 11 o'clock, they all became aware of a huge commotion and much stamping on the front porch. Thaddeus watched as Eileen went to answer the bell. She swung open the door and was greeted with the curious head of a horse, poked just inside and peering around, while outside could be heard Quentin Irwin's laughter.
"Come on, Illy," he cried. "I've got your Christmas present with me."
"Sister Andromeda!" Eileen shouted at the horse. "Oh, on my front porch!"
Quentin had parked the horse trailer right outside the front door, and his brother Johnny had helped him back Sister Andromeda out of the trailer and up onto the porch. The quarter horse was wearing a warming blanket and being led around by a white halter. She was calm and unruffled, as if she went visiting on Christmas Eve every year. Quentin explained to Eileen that Sister Andromeda was indeed her Christmas present.
"Let me grab my coat."
Thaddeus grabbed his too and tagged along. If it was about horses, he was definitely in. They steered Sister Andromeda out back. They turned on the exterior and interior lights to the horse barn and opened the corral to make their way back. Thaddeus, along with several others, followed the procession. Johnny Irwin led Sister Andromeda back through the corral and inside the barn. Eileen chose the horse stall closest to the house and turned on its overhead. The stall was empty.
"Not to worry," said Johnny Irwin. "We've got 30 bales of hay in the trailer. You all go back inside, and I'll get Miss Andromeda bedded down. We'll leave the blanket on her until the barn warms up in the morning."
Thaddeus could see the tears in Eileen's eyes as Sister Andromeda was tethered to the bar outside the stall.
I haven't kept horses since..."
Whereupon Quentin Irwin Jr. hugged her to him and patted the back of her head.
"We know, we know."
At that moment, Quentin's wife Donna pulled up in the Range Rover and began carrying riding tack inside the barn.
"English saddle," she said. "The one you like, all the rest... you can come out and get what else you might need."
Eileen laughed. Eileen hugged Donna and thanked her. Next, she hugged Johnny and thanked him. Thaddeus was stunned when she next approached him and threw her arms around his shoulders and gave him a huge bear hug.
"Thanks for coming," she whispered. "This is really nice."
Ermeline and Hector Ransom arrived at Ermeline's home at 12:22 a.m., early Christmas Day. She had had to stay a few minutes and help Bronco and Bruce close up. The tills had been counted, and the night deposit made by Bruce. The Orbit Square was now buttoned up and ready for a holiday. The only light on the entire square was on the northeast corner outside the sheriff's office. Interior lights were on as well, but it was impossible to tell how many deputies were on duty. Hector had guessed not that many, since it was Christmas Eve and everyone wanted to be home with the family. Ermeline led Hector around to the back door. Ermeline's mother was asleep in the front room. They wanted to avoid waking her if possible. She owned the couch for the night, and that was fine with Hector. He didn't plan on staying all that long anyway. Without turning on any lights, Ermeline led him into the bedroom.
"Now turn your back. I'm getting into my jammies."
He watched as she set her purse on the dresser and glided up to the head of the bed where she retrieved her pajamas from under the pillow. He turned his back to her and waited for her whisper. His eyes quickly became adjusted to the dark. There was the closet. There the door into the bathroom, there the dresser with the purse, there the door back into the hallway. It was a moonless night, as it was still snowing outside, but the light reflected up from the snow bathed the room in a soft blue light.
"Good enough to find my way around," he thought.
Finally, she whispered. It was okay to turn around. She quietly pulled back the covers on her side of the double and slid under. He waited until she was settled, and then laid down on his back beside her. He was at her side, but fully clothed, complete, with cowboy boots.
"Lose the boots," she hissed. "I don't want those clodhoppers on my bedspread."
He did as he was told and lay back down. It was all right. The boots would slip back on quietly with no effort at all. It was all part of the plan.
Johnny Bladani had laid out for him. She was asleep, lightly snoring as she always had, within 15 minutes. Hector didn't move. Johnny had told him to wait a full hour, and he would. He watched her out of the corner of his eye. Her chest rose and fell under the covers about 15 minutes each time. He was counting and keeping track of the minutes on his fingers. Plus, he had his watch. They weren't to meet until 1:30, so it was all good. He closed his eyes, certain that he would not fall asleep. There was too much to do, and he had switched over to coffee anyway after leaving the Silver Dome. The Phillips 66 on the west end of town had had fresh coffee in huge canisters, and Hector had helped himself to a 32-ouncer while filling with gas. He paid with cash, no paper trail. His only other option was a prepaid MasterCard, which he kept for those rare occasions where he might have to rent a car. The plastic remained in his wallet the entire trip. At 1:12, he lifted his arm slowly, slowly, and checked the time. Perfect. She had been sleeping without moving, and no other sounds had reached him from inside the house. In slow motion, he sat upright and then moved his feet over the side and back down inside the cowboy boots. They immediately slipped on, and he stood up, keeping pressure on the mattress until he was upright, and only then slowly releasing the inner spring. If she suddenly awoke, he would say he was looking for the bathroom. Simple enough. He made his way over to his parka and felt inside the inner pocket. It was all there. Gun, knife, gloves. He soundlessly shrugged into the coat. Then he removed the latex gloves and gradually slipped them on both hands. He removed the gun, followed by the knife. With these items exposed, he crept around the foot of the bed and gently stepped up beside Ermeline's hands. With the greatest of care, he slipped the gun barrel under the fingers of her right hand and ever so gently placed the fingers on the barrel. Just enough, just so, just capturing fingerprints along the smooth portion of the gun. Then he did the same thing with the closed switchblade. With his gloved hands on both weapons, he slowly crept back around the bed and went to the bathroom door. He waited until his eyes adjusted to the inner darkness to lessen the chance of stumbling over something there and giving himself away. Satisfied after several minutes that he knew where things were located inside, he entered the bathroom and opened the top cabinet above the towels. He felt around and felt nothing metallic or hard plastic that might rattle against the weapons. He then placed them on the top shelf of the cabinet and slowly closed the door. Back in the bedroom, he paused to listen to her breathing. He satisfied himself that she was still asleep. Very asleep. She had worked a long, hard shift and her body was tired and resting deeply. So he crossed to the dresser, found her purse, and stuck his hand inside. Instantly, he located the clip of 65 $100 bills with his fingers and eased them out. Still wearing his gloves, he inserted the money back inside his own coat pocket. Then he stopped and smiled.
"Why not?"
he thought, and put his hand back inside her purse. Just as he thought, her wallet. It felt like it was stuffed with bills, although he had no idea how much. It was from her tips for the night, and would come in handy once he was back on the road. He pulled the wallet out and put that in his other outside pocket. He had been told to take nothing but the 6,500, but no one had to know about the wallet. Then he did his inventory. He had left fingerprints only on the bedspread, where he had placed his hands, and there was no way they would ever lift prints there. He had touched nothing else since entering the small house. With the greatest of care and caution, he eased himself back down the short hallway and into the kitchen, where they had come in through the back door. He slowly twisted the knob and let himself out, closing the storm door all the way, as gently as possible, behind him. Earlier that day, Hector had met with Johnny Bladani at Moe's Aces, a Springfield watering hole on the south side of town. Moe's featured a huge sign out front comprised of four aces peeking from a deck of cards. Inside the joint, there was sawdust on the floor and peanuts in baskets along the bar and on all the tables. They were salted, of course. Studies showed that by simply offering free salted peanuts, a pub owner could expect to sell 35% more drinks and beer. For Moe, there was no Moe, there was only Arnold C. Goldsmith, Jr., the peanuts were a no-brainer. So were the very dim lights and the feeling of anonymity enjoyed by the denizens of the dive. They met just after 4, while an NBA game was blaring over the flat screen. Johnny entered and limped by several regulars at the bar. He didn't know they were regulars, but it was a strong guess, for they had that settled-in, comfortable look that regulars always have. The limp was a hoax, but if anyone remembered anything about it, it would be the limp. He passed by them and beyond the bar, averting his eyes and face, wishing to enter, meet, and leave without being remembered. He found an empty booth along the back wall, just off the bathrooms, where a strong odor of urinal cake and vomit held on. Johnny slid into the booth and partway unzipped his black leather coat. He was wearing a nondescript black baseball cap pulled over his eyebrows, and when a sturdy little man wearing a white apron approached and took his order, Johnny kept his eyes fastened on the tabletop, as if preoccupied with his cell phone, to where he couldn't be bothered to look up. He ordered a scotch and water and kept poking cell keys. The little man disappeared, and Johnny put the cell away. 5 minutes later, he was joined by Hector.
"Know anyone here?"
were the first words out of Johnny's mouth. Hector turned around and eyed the other patrons.
"Nah, first time here anyway." "Okay, now listen up. You been drinking today?" "No, sober like you said." "Any drugs? Crack? Speed?" "No, dude, you said sober and here I am."
Johnny studied Hector's face. He looked into his eyes and studied the pupils. Satisfied at last that he had a sober co-conspirator, he launched into the plan. Johnny went on for a good 5 minutes explaining to Hector how Hector would drop in at the Silver Dome no earlier than 9 p.m., talk with Ermeline, and get her on board with the Christmas Eve plan. Hector would leave there by 9:25. He would then leave his truck unlocked while he went inside the Phillips 66 on the west end of orbit around 9:30 p.m. Johnny would be filling the Escalade also at the Phillips 66, and Johnny would walk from his Escalade over to Hector's truck and leave the gun and knife on the passenger seat. By then, Victor Harrow, of course, would be lying face up in a pool of his own blood inside his mobile office, shot once between the eyes by the same nickel-plated snub-nosed .38 caliber. Hector would handle the weapons only with the napkins he would bring with his coffee. He would wipe them down totally and drop them in his inside coat pockets. Hector would give Ermeline the $5,500, which Johnny slipped to Hector under the booth, in order to enlist her participation. They wanted to prove to her that Hector's intentions were only good. Hector would accompany her just after midnight, place her fingerprints on the gun and knife, and plant the weapons in an obvious place of hiding where even the stupid butthole cops could find them, as Johnny put it. Hector would then retrieve the money out of Ermeline's purse and quietly leave.
"Take nothing else,"
he was warned. After that, Hector was free to keep the $5,500 and go wherever he wanted, just not back to the Gulf Coast. Johnny preferred L.A. or New York, where Hector could get lost for at least a year, working at some menial job for cash. Then they would be even.
"Even?"
Hector asked him.
"How does that make us even?"
"Simple," Johnny told him. "You get the cash, and you get to keep the foot in return for helping us dispose of Victor Harrow." "That makes us even," Hector could only shrug. $5,500 was better than nothing. He was glad he had packed his things in the suitcase under the F-150 bed cap. He had enough jeans and flannels to make it through the winter. He would be okay. Charlie Altman received the call from Deputy Dale Harshman at 4:30 a.m., Christmas morning. Deputy Harshman was so excited he was stuttering.
"Victor Harrow's dead, Charlie. You'd best come by the bus."
"Calm down, Dale. Secure the scene. Touch nothing."
Sheriff Altman's next act was to call the Illinois State Police and talk to the desk sergeant.
"There's been a shooting," he calmly told them. "I need the crime lab in the next 30 minutes. Victor Harrow's office bus, 2 miles east of orbit, Washington Street, purple monstrosity."
The state police beat him to the crime scene. By the time Charlie arrived, Dale Harshman had encircled the bus with yellow crime scene tape, and one of the crime scene techs was scouring the parking lot for any evidence that might even resemble a tire track. Evidently, there was nothing obvious, as she soon disappeared inside the bus. Charlie Altman put the squad car in park and went inside. He found Sergeant Mel Himmelman inside with a photographer and 2 crime scene technicians. Photographs were being taken and measurements made. Plastic bags had been taped over the victim's hands. Evidently, Vic Harrow hadn't been moved. They all acknowledged each other, and Sergeant Himmelman said,
"Notice anything about Vic?"
"I notice he's deader than hell."
"Look closer. Use your light."
Charlie shone his flashlight along Vic's body, toes to head. At the forehead, he paused.
"What is that? Somebody scratched him?"
"Look closer," said the sergeant.
"Step over here by me and bend down so you can see." "Okay, I'm looking. What the hell? E-R-M?
I guess you ran out of space."
"She carved her name in his forehead?"
"Like I said, she started to, but she ran out of room."
Charlie looked again. Dried blood outlined the deep cuts across Victor's forehead. There was no doubt. Someone had carefully engraved ERM in large, blocky letters. His mind reeled. It couldn't be. Nobody would be that stupid.
Ermeline didn't do this, Sheriff Altman finally said. This isn't something she would even think of doing.
You're the sheriff, said the female tech. Your job is to do the sheriffing now, right?
She laughed, a dry laugh, and Sergeant Himmelman scowled at her.
Well,
she exclaimed,
someone did it.
You'd best go straight over and talk to her, the state policeman said. You know how this looks, and if anyone asked me, I would have to say that would be my first item on my list, Dr. Ermeline.
Of course I'll talk to her,
Sheriff Altman said.
Take plenty of pictures.
He went to the door and jumped to the ground.
Dale, have you notified Betty Ann Harrow?
I thought I'd wait for you, Sheriff.
Right. Thanks.
Sheriff Altman returned to his squad car and placed a call. However, the call wasn't to the new widow. He was calling District Attorney Quentin Irwin, Jr.
Quentin, Charlie, we've got a situation here.
Damn, Charlie, it's not even 5. Couldn't wait?
Victor Harrell's been murdered. We need your direction.
Go ahead.
You ain't gonna believe this. Somebody carved ERM in his forehead.
Ermeline? No way. Ermeline wouldn't shoot Vic Harrow in a million years.
Totally agree.
But we'd better make a record. I'll call Judge Prelate and get a search warrant for her place. You swing back and pick it up and then pay a visit to Ermeline. Then report back to me.
You've got it.
Sheriff Altman hung up and called the new widow. It went about like they always went. Shock, disbelief, anger, depression, all within 3 minutes.